From WXXI News, it's Healthy Friday. Welcome to another edition of Healthy Friday. I'm Matthew Leonard from the Innovation Trail. I hope you can stay with us for the next hour when Evan Dawson will be along for another Second Opinion Live. He'll be looking at answering some of those great medical truisms, things like reading in dim light will ruin your eyesight and don't go in the pool until half an hour after you eat, that kind of thing. All be answered in the next hour. But in this hour, we're talking about a condition that affects nearly 10% of the population, and by 2050, as many as 1 in 3 American adults will have it. 1 out of every 4 Americans 65 and older already has it. Yes, it's diabetes. Joining me for this discussion, Dr. Joseph Stankitis, Chief Medical Officer for the Munro Plan, and Travis Hyder, the Executive Director of the American Diabetes Association in upstate New York, who led off our conversation.
Well, you know, to me, diabetes is the healthcare crisis of the 21st century. You know, it's really impossible for us to not have someone affected in our lives by diabetes. A couple years ago, the CDC said that 1 in 2 people will have diabetes or prediabetes by the year 2020. And when you start to factor in the health consequences of diabetes, the financial impact of diabetes, and of course, the personal toll of diabetes, I think, you know, that really puts us in a real epidemic situation.
I guess, Joe Stankitis, from the, you know, from the medical profession's point of view, you know, what are the, give us a kind of a sense of the way in which diabetes interconnects with a lot of other health challenges.
Well, one could consider diabetes being a wild card disease in the sense where it really affects the entire body in all sorts of ways. It's the number one cause of blindness in the United States, number one cause of renal failure, requiring people to either end up having dialysis or even going on to kidney transplants. It's an incredible risk factor for heart disease. People develop neuropathy, which is where you lose feeling in your lower extremities, and consequently, if it's not being well managed, you can have great vascular problems where you have to have amputations of toes, feet, legs. And, you know, just in general, it really affects all sorts of people, individuals. And as Travis said, it's a big issue for our country right now because as we're going through this obesity epidemic, that puts a lot of people at risk, nearly about 80, 90 million people. And on top of that, then the ones that have diabetes, and most of the folks that are pre-diabetic don't even know that they are in that situation, and it's something that they could do something about. So overall, it really does affect a lot of folks in the U.S., both clinically and also financially, too.
Yeah, I think that's worth just emphasizing the point you made about the pre-diabetes is that it is essentially without symptoms. Is that correct?
Absolutely. There are subgroups in our population that are at higher risk than others for diabetes and having prediabetes. So ethnic issues come into play, racial issues come into play in terms of one's risk for this, and also one's weight and other habits. And if you don't know you have this, then you might not be able to do the things that you need to do to prevent developing diabetes.
Right. So just on the, I guess, the racial disparity issue, since you touched on that, that means that essentially there are certain segments of the population who, because by their very definition, are more at risk and therefore need to be much more vigilant or potentially need to assume that they are candidates for at least pre-diabetes condition.
Oh, absolutely. If you look at the population in comparison to the Caucasian population, Asian Americans have a 1.2% greater risk for, not percent, but 1.2-fold risk greater than a white population. African Americans and Hispanics are about 1.7 times greater risk. And the one that really frightens me are the Native Americans, depending upon which tribe you're from. If you're from the southwestern part of the United States, 1 in 4 people have it. It's something that, again, needs to be identified so people can do what they need to do to prevent complications and even prevent developing diabetes.
And of course, many of those populations you're talking about, say the Native American population or Alaskan Indians, for example, already have other health challenges simply through the issues of poverty, access to other services, or other complications. You know, other sorts of issues that intersect with this predisposition to diabetes.
Well, absolutely. I mean, the good news is that the Indian Health Service nationally has recognized this, and you know, hopefully they can continue to get the appropriate funding to address this for the Native American populations at hand. But still and all, at the end of the day, access to really good care and all kinds of services still remains a huge challenge for these people because of the way they're scattered around different reservations and the like. And you know, consequently, it's something that we as a society need to really step up and try to address.
Right. Yeah, Travis. Yeah.
Yeah. Just on that, we just had an important victory with regards to the Native American population in Congress. The American Diabetes Association sends a group of volunteers to the Hill every March, and it's called the Call to Congress. One of our board members, Kevin Hurley, attended, as well as some other local volunteers, and they talked to our individual legislators about the importance of reauthorizing the special diabetes program. And so a key component of that is funding for Native Americans, as well as funding for type 1 research. And so this year we were able to get a two-year commitment versus what has been a one-year, having to renew it each year.
Right.
So that's a total of $600 million and a real important victory, I think, for all people affected by diabetes, because you have to remember that any of this funding, you know, could end up having important consequences for other groups and other people that have diabetes as well.
Right, especially if you're trying to establish, I guess, best practice and get some continuity of planning forward. If you're only working on the one year, kicking the can down the road scenario, it's very difficult. So at a kind of a national level, have we got a figure around the kind of cost that diabetes, an estimation of what, you know, kind of dollar figures diabetes is really costing the country and its health services at the moment?
Yeah, I think the latest number is around $274 billion in healthcare costs.
It's growing. And then the other impact that people never factor into a great degree is all the other non-healthcare associated costs, missing time from work, disability, and before you know it, you're pushing $1 trillion nationally.
Right.
When you start looking at all the various and sundry effects of the disease.
Presenteeism.
Yeah.
I believe they, right now it's about 1 in 5 healthcare dollars are being spent on diabetes.
Right. And so let's talk a little bit about we mentioned obesity, and we've talked a little bit about racial disparity. What about aging? So for people who are 65 and over in terms of their level of risk, and obviously as the population ages, this is going to be a much more, a larger segment of the population and of our care.
Absolutely. Well, when you look at the risk factors associated with the development of diabetes, age is one of them. I mean, anybody that's 45 or older should be screened. Really, they should be for type 2 or pre-diabetes. Once you hit 65, the prevalence goes up significantly. One of the issues that comes into play there is, I mean, as people age, they're not quite as active as they used to be. They might still continue their old eating habits, so then they put on a few more pounds and all that. And that does then you tend to set them up for pre-diabetes, if not type 2 diabetes. And the problem is, again, a lot of people have no symptoms initially for it. And when it does get diagnosed, they usually have some complications already in play, which make it a lot tougher for the individual.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Travis, you wanted to chime in?
Yeah, I've a personal story in regards to this. My father-in-law, this was last year, had his annual physical. He's 75 years old and, in pretty good shape. And the doctor told him that, he had just maybe a touch of sugar, and then what he should do is just cut back on his pasta a little bit. So I heard this, and I said to myself, my wife told me, oh, he's got pre-diabetes, you know, what a missed opportunity to really talk to him about it. And he's the type of guy, he's a retired engineer who would have followed, you know, the instructions, and if told him about the pre-diabetes program, might have done it. But, you know, for your son-in-law to try and convince you of this when the doctor. So this is something we're really trying to work on. And there's a great program that has empirical evidence that shows that if folks lose about 7% of their body weight, we can prevent or delay the onset of diabetes for the pre-diabetes population. And it's huge. It really is. And definitely significant in terms of the outcomes that it can have, as well as, you know, the amount of people we could affect.
Right. But you touch on an interesting point that I'd like to pursue a little bit, which is like who's sending the messages, and who do we think people are more receptive to hearing those messages from? And I'd be interested in both of your takes on that in terms of, you know, on the advocacy side, what we understand about the most effective messaging for things like, you know, a pre-diabetic condition, and what sort of approaches people need to take, because you're talking really fundamentally about some very big lifestyle, cultural issues or family issues even that can be very, very deeply, you know, ingrained in people's lives, right?
Absolutely. And Joe can certainly talk about some of the clinical aspects and his perspective as a physician and somebody in a leadership position. But, you know, I think it's a multifaceted approach. I mean, we're fully invested in the DPP program, the diabetes prevention program, that is to say. We recently received a grant from the New York Health Foundation to try and increase the amount of people that are entering the diabetes prevention program. So how we're doing that is we're going around to doctor's office and essentially doing academic detailing. We're funding a staff person, and so we're educating those care managers and those offices about the fact that, look, pre-diabetes is a serious thing, you know, with healthcare reform and the emphasis on getting ahead of, you know, the issue and prevention. This is a real, you know, way to do that. And we're trying to target certainly places that would have even higher concentrations, you know, which we kind of referred to earlier, of candidates for that. And but I think it's definitely a multifaceted approach. And whether that's making people aware through the workplace, through corporate wellness type programs, that you might be at risk for diabetes. You know, the real way to test that is certainly with an A1C level. And Joe can talk a little bit about that. But we have something as simple as a risk test, a paper risk test. You can take it online. It's 7 questions where, you know, you add up your score and it tells you whether you should go see your doctor and get a blood glucose screen. From the workplace to families, we certainly know in the Latino community, for example, that the family is vital to making change. So we have different culturally sensitive programs that we are running to try and affect that change. But, you know, it is definitely a shift, and doctors have a lot on their plate, and this is another thing to add to the mix, you know, and... But I think it's a real important thing. If we're ever going to get ahead of this curve, this is where we have to address it.
Yes, I think it's screening's important, particularly if you're at high risk. Now, as Travis mentioned, there's a risk assessment that one can take online on the ADA website. If it comes up that, yeah, you're at high risk, you know, an individual, I think today, needs to take the initiative in terms of really working closely with their primary care practitioner, be it a physician or nurse.
How do you get to the men who never go to their doctor? You know, so you know, that kind of population who are potentially, you know, I suspect probably at high risk, and who would, you know, you have to kind of drag them screaming through the door of their doctors to get.
That's a risk for everybody, and that's a real challenge. I don't have any real magical answer to that. But I think that the more that various professionals within the healthcare field and other folks, educators, are out there talking about this, the greater the effect will be. I'll give you one example. I've been working with Dr. Ira Lamster, who's the former dean of the Columbia School of Dentistry, and he's now at the Columbia School of Public Health. Periodontal disease is a huge thing for individuals with diabetes, and it's a marker for someone that has it. It hasn't been tested that you're not going to be able to treat it well unless you control the diabetes. And what we're trying to do is encourage the state of New York, Department of Education, to broaden the scope of practice to allow dentists to do the screening for your diabetes. Not to necessarily treat it, but if they discover someone's pre-diabetic or has diabetes, to make sure that they get to their primary care physician and have this addressed. That's a real opportunity out there, and it's something that could be facilitated through either legislation or else regulatory reform. But that said, that's one approach to it. The testing is well, really, there's three approaches to it. You can do a two-hour glucose tolerance test. You can do a fasting glucose test, so you don't eat after midnight, then you have it drawn. Or else you could have a hemoglobin A1C drawn, which is a marker that you do not have to fast or do anything special for, and it can be done in a physician's office anytime. Depending upon what those results are, one can be alerted to the fact that they're pre-diabetic or that they actually have developed diabetes or they don't have it. And I think then one can take it from there and go down the various pathways. If one is pre-diabetic, certainly the diabetes prevention program really is very effective. It's evidence-based. It's highly recommended. We've been involved with trying to encourage the State Department of Health to have it included in the coverage for Medicaid. I'm not sure where the hang-up is there, like from the Office of Budget or whatever, but the thing is, for 2 years running, the Benefits Advisory Committee has recommended that now this be covered. So there are various avenues for that. If someone is diagnosed with diabetes, it certainly is an opportunity to make some life changes. There's a self-management program that's available out there that is covered by pretty much, universally by the insurers. People there can find out about what they need to do vis-a-vis diet, weight control, and the like, and then also paying attention to the various aspects of their own care, like having their eyes examined, their feet checked out, and all these things that are really critical to prevent a lot of the complications. So,
is there an argument or an incentive? We've been looking at this in the insurance industry more broadly now, that they're actually looking at ways of reducing people's premiums by tracking their behavior more closely. You know, they're looking at, right, you know, driving behavior, that kind of thing. I mean, is there an incentive perhaps for people to think about these kinds of programs, if you're following a kind of a regime, that it could actually impact on your premium at the insurance level? Would that be one way to sort of implement
it? It could be. I know there's some programs that have different premiums due to people's behavior vis-a-vis smoking and tobacco use. I don't know how far one's going to be able to get with some of the advocacy groups about, well, we don't want to be discriminating against overweight individuals and the like. And that's something that's out of my league insofar as the legalities and the like. However, the thing is, the more that we can spread the word out there, for example, a program like yours here right now and whatever, the more people are made aware of really what's out there and what they need to be looking out for, I think the better off we're all going to be.
I've got two quick examples kind of related to that. One, the American Diabetes Association as an employer is choosing to fund the diabetes prevention program if an employee with the ADA qualifies and wants to pursue that. So I think that initiative can certainly come from employee groups. And for those that are self-insured, certainly that's even more of a powerful incentive. But you'll start to see, I think, even more of that stuff come about. And then I think, you know, an organization like Joe's at the Monroe Plan, we worked together on a project several years ago called the Diabetes Physician Recognition Program, which was basically an NCQA series of standards that a practice had to meet regarding diabetes care. If they met those standards, he was able to prove that there was demonstrated improved outcomes for people with diabetes. So therefore, his organization had an enhanced reimbursement. So, I mean, that type of thing, I think, is really powerful and sends the right message, and he can sort of,
yeah, we still support that program where a physician who has that recognition from the National Committee for Quality Assurance gets a care management fee above and beyond their simple reimbursement.
right.
on a monthly basis. And that really, I think, is appreciated by the clinicians. I think the other thing that's developed in terms of healthcare delivery is this thing called the patient-centered medical home, where there is enhanced reimbursement, and with the coming of all the new reforms that are going on for healthcare delivery, like here locally, the thing called DSRIP, which is the Delivery System Redesign Incentive Payment Program, that will probably enhance that. But that all said, I think on the employer side, my own organization, we were recognized by the RBA as one of the healthy companies to work for. And what we focused on was trying to do several things. One, we did not tie anything into any sort of premiums that people pay for their insurance, but it was more we wanted people to do health risk assessments, and they did that. And then we offered them all sorts of opportunities to make an impact on their behaviors. So, for example, we bring in Weight Watchers to the work site, and there are a good number of people that take advantage of that. One woman's now half the woman she was before. She lost a significant amount of weight, and it's really helped her. She
right,
was
so tapping into those other existing programs that are obviously already dealing with preconditions and so
Absolutely.
On, and integrating that as well. Just press pause there. That's the voice of Dr. Joe Stankitis, who's the CMO with the Munro Plan, and also on Healthy Friday, we're talking with Travis Hyder, who's the executive director of the American Diabetes Association, the upstate New York end of that operation. And I'm Matthew Leonard here with Healthy Friday. Thanks for being with us. And we're talking about diabetes, a really big issue. We've been talking a lot about advocacy, particular groups that are kind of predisposed to having to be more alert to the potential for diabetes. Let's talk a bit about, just change tack a little bit and just talk about a couple of advocacy events that are coming up. Travis, you can talk about the Tour to Cure and also Camp Aspire. They're both kinds of big things on the kind of calendar in upstate New York. The Tour to Cure, just give us a quick rundown
sure,
on that
sure.
and what's planned.
The Tour to Cure is our largest special event, our fundraising event, and the Tour de Cure is really a neat thing because it's a cycling event, but it's not a race. There's something for everybody, and it's us essentially living our mission. You know, it's a healthy, sustainable living activity. You know, before I came to the ADA, and I've been with the organization over 11 years, riding a bike was, you know, going around the block, but seeing the folks that do the Tour de Cure and the commitment level and how people start off, you know, doing, say, 15-mile route, and then, you know, 3 years later, I see them on the 100-mile route doing the century ride, and they're super into it. It's really impressive. But, you know, we have the fourth largest event in the country here in Rochester, so it's a tremendous hat tip to the community of how much the corporate community and folks have gotten involved in this and the passion that's there. We crossed $1 million in revenue last year, and you know, just have tremendous participation. And what's great is it's not just a one-day event. We start training, you know, right before the holidays. Once the holidays are over, we have great partnerships. Like with Midtown Athletic Club, anybody that signs up for the tour is eligible to go to winter indoor spin classes on Saturdays and Sundays, and devoted just for the tour, and folks can start to get in shape. And so, you know, what's really neat is then we progress towards, of course, this spring it seems later than ever, going outside and doing actual routes outside. So we're building to June 13th, Saturday, June 13th. Certainly there's still time for people to get involved, and they can register on our website at diabetes.org/Rochester Tour.
And Camp Aspire, let's talk about that initiative for young people, because from what I was reading about it, this was really can be a really effective way for so it's for kids who are already living with diabetes or dealing with diabetes, and it's a chance for them to sort of feel normalized amongst a community of their peers who are all kind of facing the same sort of health challenges, right?
Absolutely. So, this has certainly been the pride and joy of the Diabetes Association long before I came on board, and takes place at the Rotary facility out in Rush, New York, which is like the Taj Mahal of camp facilities. They have an Olympic-sized swimming pool, a radio station, zip lines in the woods. And these kids just are able to experience camp and life, where diabetes isn't necessarily, you know, the first thing on everybody's, you know, lips. And what's great is, you know, folks like Joe can tell them, you know, in a medical setting or in an institutional setting, you know, what they should do with diabetes and the right way to do it. But nothing replaces having a peer, you know, tell you what they're going through or seeing them change their pump site. I can't tell you the number of kids that come out from camp and their parents are raving about, you know, the progress they've made. My child would never change their pump site before, and now they're doing it. So I think moreover even than that, and we've got lots of survey information that demonstrates all the positive outcomes of camp, is just the confidence level they become that increases as they go through camp and they mature as people. We always have a showcase for our board and volunteers out at camp, and to hear, we bring a couple of the kids, to hear them speak, it's so emotional, you know, telling their story about when they were diagnosed, but then, you know, describing how they wouldn't be the same people they are today if it wasn't for camp. And being able to call somebody when you're in college or, you know, as a young adult and say, you know, yeah, I've been dealing with these, you know, really hot, huge highs. And, you know, and have somebody else actually know what you're talking about.
Right, sure.
You know, and
so it's a shared language. Really, it's based on shared experience. And also, presumably, there's a huge esteem building thing, which also helps in terms of their ability to cope going forward.
But it goes beyond that. Mm-hmm. I can give you one example. I've got two employees who have sons who are young adolescents, 12, 13, in that group, who were recently diagnosed in the past year. One of them sent her son to the camp last summer, and the neat thing was the ongoing contact after camp with the peers that they meet. I mean, the thing is, with all of the social media and all that,
yeah,
this kid's been able to at least get a cadre of new friends who have similar experiences, and they're able to exchange with each other, well, in terms of how to deal with issues that they face that other kids don't necessarily have to face day in, day out, and it's huge. And the mom that I spoke to about this said this is an incredible thing because at least he knows he's got someone that he can turn to really bounce ideas off, and that's incredible.
So we're just going to take a short break now on Healthy Friday, and we're going to come back and talk about a couple of other things, research and funding and the kind of legislative role in treating diabetes. It's Healthy Friday on WXXI. We'll be right back.
Coming up in our second hour, it's Second Opinion Live, and we tackle myth or medicine. We'll take some very common questions you have about your health, and we'll try to get some answers for you. Basic, everyday questions about the common cold, how to get a common cold, whether cracking your knuckles can give you arthritis, and so much more. If you've got some questions, let's answer them. Myth or medicine, Second Opinion Live, next hour.
Attention all above average children. Don't tell your parents, but we're planning a party.
WXXI presents A Prairie Home Companion, live on stage June 6th at CMAC. Tickets now on sale at WXXI.org/events. Presented with support from Ferris Hills and Clark Meadows, independent and enriched senior living.
Oh, my sweet, sweet old summer.
So I'm back with Dr. Joe Stankitis and Travis Hyder, and we're talking about diabetes today on Healthy Friday. And Joe, you're kind of involved in some pretty high-level conversations at the national level that bring together a lot of different stakeholders who are all tackling the diabetes issue. Could you just talk a little bit about what sort of, we were talking before we started recording, just about the huge volume of scientific literature that's out there dealing with diabetes, and part of your job is to really sort through what seems to be effective and best practice at the moment.
Well, I'm a member of the a National Professional Practice Committee at the ADA, and it's a group that has been charged with, it's been an ongoing thing for many, many years, like for the development of standards of care for diabetes. And it's a group where we have at the table, I mean, clearly endocrinologists and diabetologists. We also have people from various other disciplines that include pharmacists, also nutritionists, exercise physiologists, and also some behavioral health folks to take a look and cull through all of the literature to be able to find out what's the best practice that is evidence-based, what makes sense to do, to recommend to the primary care physician out there, how should he or she really like best treat their patient with diabetes, their patient with pre-diabetes. So these standards of care get updated on an annual basis. And every January, there's a supplement to the ADA's Diabetes Care Journal that pretty much is entirely devoted to the standards of care. The other thing with this is that it really helps identify, and it really rates what is the level of evidence for the various recommendations. And we've tried to make it as strong as possible over the past 2-3 years to really focus in on what is the best thing to do for anybody with a given issue. So that's something, and it's purely voluntary too. The members of the committee do not get compensated for it. It's a volunteer effort, and it brings people from various academic medical centers, for example, Harvard Medical School, Johns Hopkins, University of Michigan. We've got individuals from the National Institutes of Health there at the table. So it really does cut across the entire country in terms of experience and also the ability to evaluate what is really out there that really can make a difference for people.
Just looking at one thing that's coming, something that's coming up, which is the FDA's final ruling on food labeling. I just wondered whether you had any comment on that's something that's coming to effect 1st of December this year. And that's something that's going to provide a sort of a framework for much more detailed information about the kind of food we eat. Do you want to talk a bit about what impact you think that sort of initiative is likely to have on the situation?
Well, I could certainly just speak from kind of the layperson's perspective, and we really, you know, advocated for this way before it became part of the National Healthcare Initiative. In fact, in Albany County, which is part of upstate New York, we passed and we testified at the county legislature level in an effort to get restaurants have their menus labeled with caloric intake. And we're successful in that. At the same time, New York City was doing that. So we really kind of had a trailblazing, you know, experience with that. And to see that as part of a real national effort, you know, I think is really exciting. I mean, when I go into certain restaurants now that have that, I certainly notice it. And that helps to inform my, you know, decisions about what I'm ordering. And, you know, I think given the issues around obesity and the ability, you know, to affect change and not get diabetes by just losing, you know, for a lot of people, 10 to 15 pounds, that can make such a huge difference. I think something like this can be really critical.
Well, I mean, the thing with this is that's important is that really knowledge is power. And when you go in a restaurant and you have no clue exactly, well, you got several issues. Portion size is one. Okay, so you could have something that sounds really healthy for you, but if it's 2 to 3 times like what you should be ingesting,
right?
That's all calories too that you probably didn't count on. I've seen some folks believe, well, if I have a Caesar salad, it'll be great. Well, that Caesar salad and the size that you got probably has more calories than that Big Mac that you thought you were going to avoid and not have. So I think the thing is, in this situation, it's one where we want to have the consumer informed so that he or she can make the right decisions for themselves. Otherwise, it's anybody's guess, and it really, really doesn't serve us well. I mean, some people will argue, well, this is getting you into the nanny state or something, but I don't think so. I think it's more allowing the individual to really be knowledgeable and make the right choices for them. And if they want to have that high-calorie item, go ahead. I mean, that's your choice, and maybe if you're a swimmer and you burn 10,000 calories a day like one of my daughters does, it's not a bad thing. So
right, sure. But yeah, I mean, it's an interesting debate because there's this, you know, I guess an assumption that you throw all this money into scientific and medical research, you know, at this sort of very, very high level that, you know, that you can create some sort of universal cure. And in fact, something that's relatively simple, like caloric information, is likely to have much more traction, really, in terms of changing people's behavior.
Well, it gets more to, I think, unfortunately for our society, I think we're kind of bought into the idea that if you've got a problem, someone's going to develop a pill, it'll take care of it, and you can go your merry way. And unfortunately, with diabetes, you really have to make behavioral change on all sorts of levels. One, if you're a smoker, for heaven's sake, quit. That's like going in a dynamite shed with a lighted match. I mean, it really isn't a good thing to do. Weight loss, as Travis pointed out, if somebody loses 7% of their body weight, so for someone that weighs 200 pounds, it's about 14, 15 pounds, that makes a huge difference. Exercise is important. You really need to moderately exercise for about 30 minutes at least 5 times a day. There's now studies now that sitting for 90 minutes in a row and beyond isn't good for you and sets you up for diabetes.
Now, just let me clarify, you said 30 minutes 5 times a day?
No.
Or 32 minutes 5 times a week?
5 times a
week. I mean, 30 minutes 5 times a day would be awesome.
That would be awesome.
That would be great. That's the standing desk when you've got your treadmill,
right?
No, that's fine. I just wanted to be clear. So 30 minutes 5 times a week. 5 times a week, absolutely. Sure.
For that.
Yeah.
But the other thing, there are studies now that show being sedentary for extended periods of time do put you at greater risk. So, again, if you're at work, if you have to print something through a printer, don't do it with the printer that's right next to your desk. Do it at one where you've got to get up and walk and pick it up.
Well, it's a very good argument for the lunchtime walking club, which I know this particular organization definitely has, and many, many other workplaces do. Just in the time we've got, I just wanted to talk just at the legislative level, talk about the a law. There's currently a comment period open at the moment. It's called the Diabetes School Care Law. Travis, maybe you want to start off talking about that, and then we can get into a couple of the details, because this is something that will, you know, is likely to affect, you know, kids at school and people's.
Yeah. And I think, Matt, it's important to, you know, and we talked a little bit about CAMP, but to so listeners understand the differences between type 1 diabetes and type 2 diabetes. Type 1 often is developed in young people that, and they don't, their body, their pancreas does not produce any insulin whatsoever. Whereas type 2, you're not producing insulin effectively. And certainly that can progress. So really this is something that they don't have any control over in that way. So losing weight for a person with type 1 is not necessarily going to help. If the person is overweight, it might help them to control their blood sugars a little bit more. But, you know,
And that's so, about, is that correct, about 1.6 million Americans?
Correct.
With
type
1?
Yeah, right. It's a little bit less than 5% of the overall population.
Right, and the type 2 is obviously far more, is a much larger segment.
Exactly, we talked a lot about.
So this particular legislation is really directed towards kids who are living with type 1.
Exactly.
And their day-to-day experience of school. So what's going to change? What does this mean, these guidelines?
Well, kids in school, you know, still face a lot of discrimination issues. And I think this is just one way in which the American Diabetes Association has really tried to improve the lives of people in that group that are affected by diabetes. So this piece of legislation really does two things. One, it allows non-medical personnel to be trained in emergency administration of glucagon. So if someone goes into a real extreme low, that's a way to get sugar into their bloodstream very quickly. So in the past, typically, you know, and a lot of schools don't have school nurses. So this is a potential life-saving measure that also has a liability clause in there that relieves, you know, personnel of that liability issue. And so that's a real important step, I think, for kids and families that want their kids to be safe in a school setting. The other key piece of the legislation is that it allows a child to self-manage their diabetes in a classroom setting in the school if they prove that they're mature enough. So basically their doctor has to sign off on it and the parent. But if anybody, you know, knows anything about the ability to effectively manage one's health care, it a kid can lives with it and deals with it every day, and you know, can do a much more effective job of taking care of it in a timely manner if they're allowed to do that, versus, you know, perhaps being sent down to the nurse office and the nurse is in another place, you know, addressing something and having to wait, because often time is a big issue. I know Joe and I have heard all sorts of stories about situations that kids have run into.
Right. Well, you hear stories of some kids having diabetic coma, but coma from hypoglycemia, a lowered blood sugar. There was, I guess, a kid a few years ago that they found out in the field or whatever. And what it really boils down to is that I think that the school districts have to really embrace the idea that they're there to help support any kid with no matter what their problem is. And I think there's some school districts that are very progressive, some that aren't. Here locally, Honeyoy Falls, Lima Central School District, the assistant superintendent, Dr. Renee Williams, has been an incredible advocate. One of the reasons why is that she herself is a type 1 diabetic. However, in our district, and it's my district there, they are very much tuned into this. And I had one daughter who had a friend of hers develop type 1 diabetes as a sophomore in high school. She was an athlete. She had a pump. But the thing was, the coaches were clued in, some of the other kids were, that, okay, that if this girl starts acting strangely or whatever, this is a potential issue to be dealt with.
And, right.
And having that awareness is really important. There are other districts where if a kid is late to lunch and he's already taken his insulin for the lunch, goes into a class with food, it's not unheard of a teacher saying, no, you can't eat here in the classroom. Well, that's crazy, because like this child now is at an incredible risk of bottoming out his blood sugar. And then you've got a true medical emergency on your hands. So
right.
A lot of it is awareness, education, and really embracing being able to have your staff be empowered and really trained to be able to address things like this, because there's more kids with type 1 diabetes now.
And, mm-hmm. Right. And then I guess balancing that with, the, you know, obviously the desire ideally not to be stigmatizing kids or, you know, making right. them feel kind of excluded or whatever. So, yeah, there's that sort of balancing thing. Just in the couple of minutes we've got left, Travis says there had been an initiative in the Governor Cuomo's executive budget to consolidate some programs within chronic disease prevention and control, and then actually make some savings in that. That wasn't successful. Why was that a good outcome from your point of view at the ADA?
Yeah, we've argued, and this has been proposed before, that we maintain separate lines for this type of funding, that's real critical. I think when things are all combined together, it's easy to, have things get missed, you know, and so we consider that a success. And the fact that we were able to maintain funding, I think, is real important to, diabetes prevention and control programs throughout New York State.
And at the federal level, the Medicare Diabetes Prevention Act, do you want to tell us what you think that that's a bill that's been introduced, hasn't gone through the House yet, but why would that make a difference in terms of Medicare?
Well, given the fact that people over 65 will typically find themselves under Medicare, they are at a higher risk for developing diabetes and have a higher percentage of individuals who are pre-diabetic. It makes sense. The thing is that if you've got a large number of people who are then diagnosed as being pre-diabetic, you can now do something about it, and you can remove that financial barrier potentially from accessing a program that's evidence-based that will prevent diabetes from developing. So I think it's, from my perspective, would be a no-brainer, but politics is politics, and I think we have to be diligent in terms of advocating for this with our various congressional folks and making sure that this does go through.
Yeah. Dr. Joe Stankitis, Chief Medical Officer with the Monroe Plan, and Travis Hyder from American Diabetic Association, the upstate New York end of that, is the Executive Director. Thanks very much for talking diabetes today on Healthy Friday. It's been great to have you with us.
Our pleasure.
Thank you very much.
And a podcast of that discussion could be found, like all the Connections programs, at wxxinews.org. Check that out this afternoon if you missed any of the discussion that we just heard. Still to come, Second Opinion Live with Evan Dawson after the news, but just a little preview of next week, next Friday, which will be Innovation Friday. We're going to hear from Jennifer Henley, who was recently in Rochester speaking at RIT about cybersecurity. She knows a bit about that. She's the Director of Security Operations at Facebook. We're going to bring you a sort of excerpts from the address that she gave there. She got into technology because she loved maths and stats. She's previously worked at eBay and PayPal, but now she's at Facebook. Let's hear a little sample of what we can hear from Jennifer Henley next Friday on Innovation Friday.
We must have empathy. The ability to understand other people's feelings, share other people's feelings. And maybe you're better at it at one than the other, and that's fine. But empathy is what needs to drive the problems we're solving and help us determine how to apply those solutions. Empathy is what's going to allow us to solve and tackle these complex problems and challenges that are in front of all of us. To look at people and making the world better versus just doing things because we can. You are all incredibly smart individuals. I have no doubt you're here. And there are probably a lot of things you can do just because you can. Think beyond that. What do you need to do? What technology can you invent? You are the future of this space. You are the people who are going to be famous in security someday. What are you going to do to change this? How are you going to think beyond yourself, beyond your own personal gains, but to the world as a whole and the internet as a whole and how to make that better? Protection is at the core of what we do, most of us. You can go to DEF CON and you can see some other sides of that. But for most of us who are drawn to this space, it's protection, it's defense. We want to protect employees. We want to protect students. We want to protect people living their lives online. And in some cases, we want to protect lives. That's what we're doing. That's what security is all about. And when I think about the state of our workforce, and I think at how we need to look at this diverse and broad group of people, we have a problem. You all can help fix that.
And there'll be more from Jennifer Henley, Director of Security Operations at Facebook. That was taken from her address to RIT earlier this month. That's next Friday at Innovation Friday. Stay with us because it's Second Opinion Live with Evan Dawson. Evan and the visitors will be looking at the great medical truisms, things that your grandparents or parents maybe told you were true, things like reading in dim light will ruin your eyesight, and don't go in the pool until half an hour after you eat. How true are those things? Your chance to participate. Second Opinion Live with Evan Dawson coming up right after the news. This has been Healthy Friday. I'm Matthew Leonard. I'll be back with you for Innovation Friday next week. Thanks for being with your public radio station.